broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. You're listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast here on Full Service Radio, fullserviceradio.org. Remember that.
In the Line Hotel.
Remember that in the fabulous Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
The place to be seen.
So,
it's a super sceney.
It
place.
Is super sceney. I just saw myself in the reflection, which impresses me, if no one else. Listen, everybody who knows us from, if you're local, you know us from Foodie and the Beast. We've been on the radio, on broadcast radio for 9 years, and that show is more of a variety show. We have guests.
It's more of a party.
Yeah, you know, they're running in and out. It's like a crazy race to get everybody on the air. This is more of a deep dive into single subjects, and it's I like this. This is fun.
Well, it's fun because it gives us an opportunity to talk to some of the movers and shakers, literal shakers, in this case, in D.C., with all the fun things that they're doing. And we get to dive in deep instead of just like an 8-minute quick bit.
Speaking of shakers, Glendon Hartley is probably, I would say you're the at the top of the pyramid of mixologists in this town. Wouldn't you, Glendon? I'm sure you would.
Glendon
Just say yes.
I would never say that.
Yes,
no.
You
Come
would.
Come on, dude.
All right,
like
not
close to
step
the
up to the plate.
Just not on the mic. But no, yes, no. Well, we can say that. So,
well, we've had Glendon on Foodie and the Beast several times. And, I mean, always interesting. Always a real, talk about deep dives into the real nitty-gritty of cocktail and the spirits and all of that. So, we've got him on today. We're going to talk brandy. We're going to talk a lot of things.
Well, so there's so much going on in the spirit world in D.C.
Definitely.
And we've really, every time we've had you on before, we kind of talk about something specific, a spirit that you're currently really hot on.
Every time she says spirit world, I think of ghosts.
I was just in New Orleans.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There was literally a ghost in my hotel room. And I don't believe in ghosts, but it was scary
as... Full disclosure, it was me.
Okay, it was scary.
How was it?
F.
That's the question.
It was really scary. Anyway, but to the point, now here, back here in D.C. where there are no ghosts. So let's just get a little history on you, Glendon. And we should say, first and foremost, you're from the service bar. It's your place of business. But you have a varied background. So what? How did you get an education in
spirits?
When did
you start drinking, Glendon?
Right.
I don't think I should say when I started drinking.
Okay, you can say it on air.
Hi, Mom.
Exactly. So I guess as far as what pertains to me being in D.C. and learning about alcohol, all started in New York. Mm-hmm. So I was a bartender in Rockville, Maryland for a long time.
Okay.
I started going to fashion school, actually, in New York. And I could not get a job to save my life in the restaurant
but
industry or the bar
industry. But you always dress so nice.
Industry.
You always look so handsome.
I could get a job at a retail shop, but that's not what I wanted to
that's
do.
That's not what you wanted
I wasn't
to do.
Making me look like a schmo today.
So I went on several interviews. I needed, you know, New York City experience, blah, blah, blah. But it led me to basically take the bartending and service industry career a little bit more serious.
So you didn't go with intentions of being in it, but once you got there, you were like, huh.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I basically traveled back and forth to school for 2 years because I was still bartending down in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And found a gentleman that was teaching people and giving people an education on classic cocktail and spirits making and wine making and beer making.
Who was
and,
it?
It was John Arroyo over at Founding Farmers.
Yeah. But this was really at the beginning before it was like the thing.
Exactly. This is 2007.
No, he was in on it really early.
He was one of our first guests. And
no, he wasn't.
Yes, he was.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was. Early 2009.
Whatever. He wasn't. It's okay. It doesn't matter.
Bet me.
So back in 2007, 2008, when I met John, is when I really started focusing on educating myself more about spirits and beer. And I came into the, I guess, mixology world on a different axis. A lot of people were traditionally trained in wine or were sommeliers, and then they worked their way up and learned more about spirits, whereas I came in and learned about how to make and produce spirits first, and then kind of learned everything after that. And classic cocktails were kind of how I started as well.
Well, I think what's interesting about John is when John came down here, he did come down from New York. And it was sort of at the same time where Derek was sort of rising up. And, you know, he was a somm, and now he was getting really into spirits. And you had Todd Thrasher, who's here at the Line Hotel.
Just somm.
Yeah, exactly. Just somm. You know, you sort of had, like, there was this bubbling cauldron of people who were really starting to take cocktails seriously, and that leached down from what was already going on in New York and what was going on in LA, right?
Yeah, but it was more than just cocktails, because the craft brewing thing was happening and craft distilling was starting too.
Well, it was all coming together at the same time.
So everything kind of came together at the perfect point for me to come and actually start learning everything that I wanted to learn at the time.
So as you were learning and you were under John's tutelage, what was grabbing your attention then? Like, what were, because I know we all evolve. So where did you start, and then where did you grow to?
So we started with all categories of spirits, learned everything, learned how to taste, learned where everything's made, how everything's made. But then I really gravitated towards vermouth, because that was so intriguing to me. I was like, what is this? How is it made? Why is
it so? What was it about vermouth specifically that was so intriguing? Because it's not a strong spirit. It's not a spirit. I mean, there's a lot of floral. There could be really floral. There could be some botanicals, but it's not like a whiskey or a scotch.
Yeah, but isn't vermouth actually a wine?
Vermouth is a wine. It is a fortified wine.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, when you talk about spirits, there's this line of demarcation between spirits and wines. But you get a lot out of grapes, man. A lot of the stuff we're talking about
there
today
are.
Comes from grapes.
So the cool thing about vermouth, well, the main reason why I wanted to study vermouth so much back then is because no one could really give me a straight answer on vermouth. No one really knew how it was being produced by the larger producers. No one knew kind of how to make it in general. So.
And back then, it really just was the larger producers. I mean, now you've got Capital Vermouth, Capital Line, right?
Capital Line was really good.
Yeah, which is really good. But, you know, 10 years ago, it was just, what was that? Is it Martini Rossi vermouth,
Martini
right?
Martini Rossi,
And people thought vermouth was something you just, like, showed to a martini glass.
Exactly.
Right? To make your martini.
And I think it's because people weren't really taking care of the product, and it was just something that, you know, they thought really old martini drinkers would drink.
It had to be on your bar.
Exactly.
But it wasn't you didn't have to take care of it.
Exactly.
That bottle could be 8 years old.
So that was the thing where I was very intrigued by, why is this thing sitting on our back bar and what is it? So from there you realize that vermouth is fortified. So what's it fortified with? In a lot of times,
what does fortified mean?
Fortified mean, it means that it has spirit added to it. So it is a wine, but it does have some spirit added to give it an extra push.
And when you say spirit, what kind of spirit?
Exactly. And that was what I basically set out to learn. So a lot of them do have brandy as the spirit that is added to fortify it. So they would take their own grapes, ferment it into wine, steep it with whatever herbs, spices you're going to steep it with, and then they would distill some wine and then fortify their vermouth with it.
Okay, so then as you began your deep dive into vermouth, what did you find out? Did you start searching out? Because there are areas, especially over in Europe, where vermouth is, you know, people drink it on the rocks. It's really like an aperitif. People really drink it.
Exactly. So when I started studying that is when I really came across how big of a category brandy was. A lot of it was added to the vermouths. But then I'm also a huge fan of, you know, fruit, anything made from fruit. So that's when I really started studying.
I mean, like apple juice?
No, I love apple juice. You know, I'm a big fruit eater, I would say. So I realized that I could basically make alcohol out of any type of fruit, and that's when I started studying the different categories of brandy, starting with Calvados in general.
So were you looking to make your own? Was that a priority in your education?
It's a priority for me to know how to make every single thing that I use on a daily basis. So especially in the restaurant industry, I want to know where everything comes from. I want to know how it's made, who's making it, and basically everything that leads up to my final cocktail, to my final product.
So when you...
Because you're OCD or because customers really want to know?
That's because I'm OCD.
That's a point.
But don't you think, I mean, given... So we haven't really talked about what the service bar is.
Yeah.
But I would assume that a large portion of your clientele understands the kind of cocktail bar that you are. And they have those. It's an educated clientele.
Exactly.
They have those questions. Yep. So why don't you, for the people listening, explain the service bar, where it is, and sort of, because you opened it two years ago?
About a year and a half.
Year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So, because it's a very special place.
It's a little gym.
It is.
It's a little cocktail gym. So basically, service bar is our version of bar mini meets an Irish pub. We love Irish pubs. We think they're some of the most comfortable places to hang out and have a drink with your friends. But we also love a high quality of cocktail and being able to provide that in a very non-pretentious atmosphere.
That's almost an oxymoron when you say Irish pub and high quality of cocktail.
Exactly.
But
I think that was the case a long time ago. I don't think that's necessarily the case now.
Yes. Now in Ireland, maybe, but traditionally, historically?
No, I'm even talking about Irish pubs here, like in the States. I think everybody's raising their game, don't you? Not everybody, but
I mean, the first level of Dead Rabbit is an Irish pub, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, we want it to be comfortable. We want it to be a neighborhood place that just had really good cocktails that anyone could come to.
And were you able to execute it? Did your vision and your reality combine? Did it work?
I think that what ended up coming out is far beyond what I actually envisioned from the beginning.
Isn't that exciting?
So I'm very happy about it. I'm happy about the staff and the people that wanted to come and open this thing with me. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy that all the guests come out and they know they're going to get something great. And they ask those type of questions to us, actually.
Do they ask you? Never mind. I've got a out there trivia question. Do you know where the name Dead Rabbit comes from?
I do not.
I do not either.
Nobody saw the... It was a gang in New York in the Bowery. It was an Irish gang, and they used to go to war against other Irish gangs and other American...
Like West Side Story?
Like so Gangs, like of, New
gangs
York.
Of New York.
Right.
There you go. And by the way, Founding Farmers opened in 2008, and he was one of our first guests.
He was one of our first guests.
Yes, he was.
I don't care when they opened. I know when they opened.
All right, this is our first fight, everyone. Terrible, after 21 years of marriage.
Anyway.
All right, so...
Yeah.
I will concede he may have been on our show the first year, but he was definitely not one of our first guests. Anyway,
okay.
So back to Glendon.
Okay. Oh, Glendon, this is all about you, isn't
right.
it?
God. Okay, so what is on the menu at the service bar? So if people come in and they're real cocktail aficionados, and they can look at the menu and be like, okay, I'll do one of those. But for the uninitiated, even though you say your cocktail bar is for everybody,
yes.
I think people don't know what they want, and they know they want a good cocktail, but they don't understand the balance, and they don't understand the acid.
It's probably intimidating too for some people.
How do you walk them through it?
So I have two different ways I'm going to answer this.
Okay, great.
One of them stems from an argument I actually had with my business partner a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Guest walks in, kind of wanted a cosmopolitan type drink. Like, I drink Cosmos, but you know, we had this menu with, you know, over 80 drinks on the menu. And he kind of went out of his way to make her something else that wasn't a cosmopolitan, but that he thought that she would like. And it happened twice. She didn't like either of them. Made her a Cosmo. My stance is...
If you want a Cosmo, drink a Cosmo.
The customer is always right.
No, the customer is not always right, but in that instance...
In that regard, the customer is.
I believe with Nikki on that one. I don't really think the customer is always right all the time, but in that respect, if someone comes in and they like a specific drink...
She wants a Cosmo, she gets a Cosmo.
Exactly.
Right. Well, she is right.
In that particular instance. So if a guest wants a Cosmo, that's where their comfort zone is. That's what you should make them.
Right.
Make them the best representation of that drink that you can possibly make for them. And that's how they get their comfortability with you. And
that's how they learn to trust.
Exactly.
Trust the bartender.
You know, this is no different than when there are Psalms that Nikki doesn't like Rieslings and you'll never get her to drink one.
No, I mean, I drink them because they pour them for me.
Jump through their own noses trying to find a Riesling that Nikki will like, and it's like, why bother? She doesn't want it, man.
There are Psalms who will, I'll order something else. They'll pour me a Riesling and they'll be like, so do you like it? Now I know what they've done. And I'm like, yeah, I like it. It's fine. Delicious. Thank you. Now will you please pour me my white Bordeaux, which is what I really want. Thank you very much.
That's how she responded to the last gift I got. Yeah. Yeah,
thank
I like
you.
It. Yeah.
We
yeah.
we kind of do that when people are ordering drinks. Sometimes we don't trick them and give them something different. We always make them what they want, but we always offer people something else. So, like, let's say you came in and you got a Cosmo, I'd make you that drink, and then I'd probably make you a small version of something else that I think you might like.
Oh, that's such good customer service. That's so smart.
And you have to, and it's, you know, it's giving them something. It's more quality.
Well, not to belabor this point, but I think that one of the things that's interesting, just like people pouring me the Riesling because they want to show me that I'm wrong. Yeah. I don't think that's something you really want to do with your customer. If she says, I like a Cosmo, it's almost judgy to say, you're not drinking a Cosmo.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing wrong with a Cosmo. It may not be in vogue at the moment, although I believe it's coming back.
Yeah.
But nobody should have to feel like they're not...
No one should... You should not make your guest ever feel uncomfortable in your space.
Well, you shouldn't feel like you're not cool or chic just because you ordered a... We're not curing cancer here. It's a Cosmo, right?
That's also my my battle with a lot of New York bars that I've been to.
Oh, yeah. They could be super...
They do that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
I always refused to do that when I started making or taking, you know, cocktails and spirit seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I kind of want to tell you... so another really easy way that we kind of get our guests into the menu is we have like an all-day menu that's $7 drink. So you can have a really good cocktail for $7. Like an old-fashioned.
Wait, all day?
Yeah. So
what time do you guys open?
5 o'clock.
Okay.
So
5 o'clock starting at 5 o'clock. Yeah. All day from 5 o'clock.
5 to 2 and 5 to 3. But we call it all day because it's essentially our happy hour menu. So it's happy hour, but it's all day happy hour.
And what kind of things do you have on the menu?
So we have a Pop and a Pony, which is like a little baby beer and a shot. And then we have a classic daiquiri.
Pop and a Pony. I like that.
Yeah. And then we have a classic mint julep, and we have an old fashioned.
Oh.
Yeah.
For $7?
For $7.
I mean, you know, I don't think there's any place else in the city you can get a cocktail, a well-crafted cocktail, for that kind of price.
That was a part of our business plan from the very beginning.
I'm just saying, you could give them a little shot of whiskey and a little something to eat and call it Foodie and the Beast, couldn't you?
I might have to actually do that.
You might have to.
That's actually unbelievable.
Cool. Shameless.
He is shameless. That is accurate. Plug. All right, so right now, you're really, I know we keep mentioning brandy, but you're really hot on it.
Yeah.
And, why? Why the, you know, why the lust for brandy at the moment?
I think it's not just the moment.
Okay.
Now it's becoming more of something that people have incorporated into their beverage programs, and more people are studying it, and it's becoming a thing that's not on the back burner on your menu, but it can be a fully integrated part of your menu. But
you can, in other words, brandies can also be made from grapes too, and what I'm fascinated by is how all these variations on that theme occurred. I mean, who invented brandy and why if they were doing something else?
Well,
what is brandy? Okay. Let's start there.
First and foremost, what is brandy? So brandy is basically any spirit, any distillate that comes from a fruit. The only way that I can differentiate is that by telling you that whiskey obviously is made from grain. So whiskey is essentially made from beer, and it's distilled beer. And brandy is made from wine. So you can have cherry wine, you can have apple wine or cider, or you can have any type of wine, you know?
Okay.
It's the wine of the fruit. And then because there is a spirit added to it. No, that's vermouth. Sorry, I'm getting confused.
That's vermouth and port. They have spirit added to the wine.
Okay.
They're fortified. So brandy, you're basically taking your fermented fruit juice, your wine, and you're distilling that. It always comes
out. So what is that process? So what is the difference in if you're making it wine?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between fermenting and distilling?
Yeah, are you fermenting it first? Like
yes.
Walk us through the process if you don't mind.
Actually, it's great that you asked me that because
I am so good at questions.
Didn't you say when we were coming in here, ask me this?
So this is the easiest way to describe it, and that's why I love Pisco so much, because Pisco is a great brandy.
Wait, is Pisco a brandy?
Pisco is made from several different types of grapes, and it's unaged. So as opposed to Cognac and Armagnac and Calvados, which are aged. So
why didn't I know that Pisco is a brandy? You know, I think the problem with Pisco is that people just think of Pisco sours.
That is a huge problem. That's why.
But it is. Wait, it's National Pisco Sour Month? Yes.
Yes.
Woohoo! Yeah, okay. So, all right. So tell us about how brandy
is
made. Let's do that.
I hope she's always excited about brandy and cocktails. So, well, to piggyback off of that,
yes.
The reason that everyone thinks that the Pisco Sour is what Pisco is because that's the drink that kind of put its name to fame. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do Brandy Cocktail Room at Service Bar to kind of show people that Pisco isn't just a Pisco Sour. It's a bunch of other different cocktails as well.
But was Pisco created as a brandy that people would sip on and then this cocktail was made? Like, which came first?
It's definitely the spirit. Mm-hmm. So if we go back a few hundred years, there was a huge viticulture in South America. The Spaniards came in. They started producing more wine. The Spanish government, after a while, stopped importing wine from Peru because they were selling more wine from Peru than they were selling their own Spanish wine in Spain. So once they stopped letting the South American producers sell their wine, they started producing more grape distillate in Peru and the surrounding areas itself.
As a way to sell it back in Spain?
As a way to sell it in a different way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
but they were pissed
because
off.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's talk. You ferment your wine.
So you take your grapes, mm-hmm. smash them, let them ferment. You
right.
ferment
into put them wine. In a barrel, put them in a steel case, one or the other, right? Yep. Doesn't matter?
Yep. So okay. sometimes you can strain out the grape skins and mm-hmm. the lees and things like that. But a lot of times people will just leave it in. So you take your wine and then you distill it. Whenever you distill anything, it's always going to come out white. So this
but
is
what's
a
the
pure
process of distilling? I just
she for wants people, to build a still. Come oh, on, man.
I mean, okay, I want to understand how it works.
So basically, alcohol will evaporate at a much quicker level than water will. So it takes a lot less heat and energy to distill alcohol. So you distill your you take your pot and then you heat it to a certain temperature. Usually that ranges within 60 to, you know, 75 degrees. So once you start distilling
your wine,
mm-hmm. It'll start trickling out of the still.
Okay.
It's essentially the same method used in whiskey production and everything.
But usually
for the last
when you see a still,
years.
You see the thing, the fire underneath the large yeah. cauldron. And then there's that
this
curly
is actually,
cube.
This is actually modeled after a still. So you would have heat underneath here.
This is
here.
The Pisco?
Yes.
And
this
then
is a
what
beautiful
goes up
bottle.
Through the, is it the alcohol that goes
so
up?
So alcohol will rise yep, up through yep, here, yep. and then it would get condensed, and then it would come down.
Yeah.
So heat goes up here, and then you'll have a little condenser here that basically cools this, the alcohol, the evaporated alcohol down, and then
so
it'll
it liquefies.
Just come down. Exactly.
So, but as far as flavor goes, when you're distilling, How do you control it so you get the end product that you're looking for?
Exactly. That's all in the eye and the palate of the distiller. So whatever that comes off the still first is always going to be poison. So you're going to take that out.
It's going to be poison?
Yeah. Essentially, it's very poisonous. It's
so how do you know?
Unfermented.
How do you know when you've gotten past the poison?
Well, they distill in three separate sections. So the first few things that come off your still, they're going to set that on the side. Those are going to be the heads. The middle part is going to be the heart. And then the very last run off the still also is going to have some poisonous chemicals in there too. But
chemical, naturally producing chemicals.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's not just alcohol that comes through the still. It's unfermented sugars. Water comes through there as well. Different types of oils, essential oils and things come through.
So how did they must have found out originally when a couple people kicked off and they said, don't drink that.
Yep. People
hey,
die. People
hey,
go blind.
Pete's
you know?
Dead. Don't drink that.
But this process had been, you know, mastered in Europe long before it came to South America. So
is it a matter of timing it so you know what's coming out isn't...
It's a matter of timing, but nowadays it's not really a matter of timing it because most stills are run on electricity. They're run by computers, so they know exactly how much alcohol is coming out. They know the exact percentage. They know how much chemical content the spirit has as it's coming out, and they can pick and choose and then blend some of the heads and the tails back in to get the flavor that they want.
Well, so what about, since it is it's a high volume
yes.
alcohol, are they able to control that when it comes to brandy, when they're distilling it?
Actually, I would say that it's
or is
much
it predetermined?
Easier. I feel like it's much easier to control when it's brandy, only because most of the producers are producing through pot stills, which means you take this, you're heating it from the bottom, it's going up a certain amount of alcohol and
spirit is going to come out. A lot of times in gin production, vodka production, they have column stills, which is basically a large column that basically just runs continuously. They pour in beer from the top, and it just consistently evaporates spirit out on the other end. They can run those stills for days at a time, whereas with Pisco or Cognac, they'll run it for a certain amount of days, and then they'll stop, and they only have a certain amount of time that they can actually produce a spirit.
Well, speaking of pot stills, has anybody tried infusing spirits with marijuana?
Yes. A few people have. That's been going on for a long time.
It has at my house. No.
Way before
how does that,
it was
how
legalized.
Does that work? I mean, what is the effect? Does it smooth out the effect of the spirits? What does it do?
Glendon's like, I don't want to answer this question.
I can answer it. I'm not a huge proponent of it just because I've seen what happens when people are smoking and drinking together.
You fall down
and I don't really recommend it, and I don't really recommend...
Wait, you don't recommend drinking the spirit?
I don't really recommend smoking weed and then going out and drinking cocktails.
Is it the same effect essentially as if you smoke and then drink?
Essentially, it's a little bit more concentrated because what you're doing is you have alcohol that's basically infusing and taking in that THC content. Essentially, the same that, you know, it's essentially when people were dying because of that concentrated THC. Stuff that they were doing like a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's as bad as that, but I mean, for you to consume alcohol that has other chemicals in it besides what's going to be in it, I don't really recommend it.
You just feel like you're mixing two things that don't make sense together. Yeah.
Well, it probably makes you, instead of
smoke your weed, eat your edibles, and probably then, makes you know, drink
hey, listen,
another
I have
day.
To be, I mean, we're on this, but I even for me, edibles, it's the component of edibles that I have a problem with is it's like...
Well, you don't know what you're getting, right?
You don't know what you're getting. You have no
exactly.
idea. I feel like Alice in Wonderland. You know, like, eat me, take a small bite. Oops, I ate too much. Like, it's, you know,
she used to be 6'1".
Wait, but also, you know, if they're in cookies or brownies and they're yummy and you take a bite and they're like, just take a bite. But I'm like,
But you want to eat the whole thing.
It's a cookie.
Then you're done.
Right. So, yes. So
I feel like that's
anti-
the same thing with spirits because I don't really feel like people that are doing it at home infusing it are really weighing everything out, making a proper infusion, you know, doing it that way.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
It's kind of like moonshine, essentially.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me.
Okay.
All right. Well, so let's go back to the brandies because you brought a whole bunch of different ones.
I did.
I mean, you brought a lot. So why don't you tell us... Do we have to take a commercial break?
We do. You want to take a break? All right, we're going to take a break.
We're going to take a commercial break, and then we're going to try some brandies.
Woohoo!
This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a minute.
Original music on the break here by Kido, K-I-E-D-O. Find him on SoundCloud. This one's called Hit 'Em Up. A little trap beat here for your Monday. This is Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, and we'll be right back.
Okay, David and Nikki Nellis with Industry Night and Foodie and the Beast. We are back on air. We are live at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio, and we are talking with Glendon Hartley. We're talking about brandies and Pisco. Well, Pisco is a brandy, and we're really getting an education on how brandy is coming back into the spirit world and why it is such an important spirit and why you should know about it and maybe you should be drinking it.
You have to say the spirit world. It's the real world.
The
spirit
world.
They don't drink brandy in heaven.
Ooh. They might. You don't know. Okay, so we were talking about the fact that Pisco is a brandy, and that's and you brought in all these beautiful bottles. What did you pour us first?
So first, I poured you an Achelado Pisco, which is basically a blend of different grapes.
We're sharing. Relax. We are sharing. Oh, my God.
I'm sitting down
he
here.
Always thinks he's missing out on something.
I'm at the far end of the
it's
table. My wife is slugging down Pisco, and I'm sitting here.
That's what sounds torture like a great night. Every day. Torture.
So Pisco in Peru is basically made by distilling fermented grape juice, wine, essentially. And the cool thing about Peruvian Pisco is that you are not allowed to dilute your product with water. So earlier you were asking me, how do they know when it's ready? They're basically tasting all the time, and they wait till it gets to the proper alcohol content, and that's when they stop distilling, and they'll pour it for you.
Do you ever, like, as you would with whiskey, put ice in Pisco?
You can. That's not.
Does it wreck it? Does it dilute it too much?
Pisco really, is a very.
This is softer than a whiskey. This is not.
Well,
as,
not only that, that's yes. very. It's fruity. There's no burn.
It's very
at
floral.
All. Yeah.
This is a very well-made product.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really expecting it. So why, when we're we'll get to the other brandies, but why is it when we're talking about Pisco that they make this Pisco sour? That feels like there's just a lot going on with that. You know, when the Pisco Sour arrives, there's the egg whites. It just feels like there's so much going on. I mean, it feels like you really lose the spirit.
Yes.
So why?
Well, first off, I want to say, if you like that, you're really going to love this one.
Okay. Well, right. Let me try that.
So as everyone knows, we had Prohibition here in America. So during Prohibition, a lot of American bartenders went to other countries to practice their craft.
And they picked it up.
And, you know, Americans, we are we are known for inventing the cocktail. So, you know, the old-fashioned, but also, you know, the whiskey sour. So when you go and you try a new spirit, you're going to try something that is recognizable to you. So
Sure. They
took this spirit, and they mixed a little bit of a lime juice, some egg white, because that's how you would make a Pisco Sour. And then they had limes as opposed to lemons down in Peru and South America, and they created a Pisco Sour.
But were they already doing up at Pre-Prohibition, were there a lot of drinks with egg whites? Was that a normal thing to do?
So it was normal for you to make a whiskey sour or a sour with egg whites.
Because they thought it would coat the stomach? Was there a medicinal reason for it? It just seems like an odd thing to do.
Egg white gives you that nice foam and texture.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to realize that a lot of, well, you probably already know, but a lot of the spirits were not as refined as they are today. So when you're adding that citrus and you're adding the whiskey,
well, also,
you wanted to kind of make it a little bit richer, fuller on your palate.
Well, and egg whites, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they can also, well, I guess if you're drinking it, it doesn't matter, but they also help pull out impurities.
Well, how can they pull out impurities?
Well, I know.
You're drinking it.
But like, so like in Italy, when they make stocks,
I cannot claim that.
They put egg whites
to suck up
all the impurities in their consommés.
That makes sense. That's not the case here.
That's not the case here. Okay.
No, because they're not eating the egg whites.
Right. No. You filter it out.
So basically every time you have a sour mix at a dive bar or a nightclub or something, anyone that has sour mix, it always has some type of egg white. It's usually a powdered egg white, and they started doing that towards the turn of the 20th century.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, okay, the second Pisco that you poured us.
Yes.
Now that it's really in a like an artisanal bottle.
Exactly.
It looks like it's a ceramic bottle. It's stronger. It has a way stronger smell. You could when you put your nose to it, you tear up a little bit.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
This is more of a traditional way of making Pisco.
Mm-hmm.
So Nusta is basically you're taking wine and you're taking those grapes, I apologize, and you're crushing them and you're going to let that juice ferment into its wine. But you know what grape juice tastes like from grapes,
mm-hmm.
correct? And then you know what wine tastes like. They taste very different. So the process...
Not Manischewitz, but...
Not Manischewitz.
But let's keep going.
Right. That's another show altogether.
Exactly. So the process that they call it is mosto verde. There's a green must on the top of the wine as it's fermenting. And then what they do is they take that wine when it's half fermented, and they distill that. And what that does is it brings all those floral and fresh qualities of the actual grape juice itself and that fermented spirit both together. So you get this spirit that is higher alcohol content than the first one you had before because it's very artisanal, but it's also very soft in the palate and very floral, very
so
light.
So what is, for example, and I know how it's made, but grappa, what's the difference between grappa
and... Yeah, is grappa a brandy?
That is one of the most common questions I get. When anyone's asking
well, I'm one of the most common people you'll ever meet, Glendon.
But wait, is grappa from the seeds? What is grappa?
So grappa is basically what's left over after wine production.
It's basically the shit at the bottom.
Essentially. Yeah. And then they take that and they distill that.
Because they're like, we use everything.
Because when you want to use wine, you want to use like the good stuff. You want to use the heart of it. You don't want to use like all the stuff with the sticks and the stems and the leaves. So they... that don't want to waste anything. They'll leave the good wine for themselves, and then they'll distill this product afterwards, which is why kind of grappa has a, it's got kind of like a bad rap in the brandy game because it can be
very, very harsh. Gasoline.
I think the newer grappas.
The newer grappas, some of them are fantastic. The Nonino family makes a fantastic grappa.
But since we're talking about the brandies, when I think of, and don't get angry, but when I think of an apple brandy or I think people get confused that some of these brandies are just like sugar messes.
Yeah, they're sticky
exactly.
Sweet.
You know?
That's another misconception of brandy itself because, yes, you are distilling from a fruit that has sugar, but they are not sweet by any means. Some of them have a little bit of unfermented sugars that come through. And there can be a little bit of sugar on the palate, but they're just like any other spirit.
I think people think that because the cheapo ones, it's almost like they then infuse back in the fruit flavor so that when you're drinking apple brandy, it tastes like apples.
They're apple liqueurs that add back that sugar flavor.
So is that like what a schnapps is?
A schnapps is basically a spirit that has sugar added to it.
Yeah.
Do you know what's funny?
But it does have the flavor of the...
Earlier in my life, when I was hanging in the bars, we used to drink schnapps shooters. Point where... And I will say about schnapps...
That makes my whole
schnapps, body hurt. Schnapps, especially peppermint schnapps, tastes the same coming out as it did going in.
Oh.
And when you said schnapps,
and
my stomach revolted.
And I don't want to know which revolted. Way it was going out.
No, no, no.
That's disgusting.
It comes out the mouth, you numbskull.
I have been known to consume peppermint schnapps.
Okay.
But I mean...
This isn't an AA meeting.
No, I was going to say, I haven't had schnapps in probably 30 years, and when you said it, my stomach kind of flipped over. Yeah. Don't even.
All right, so you poured two other brandies. These
yes.
are not Piscos.
They are
but
not.
What's interesting is that they are colored.
Yes.
So why is that?
So those
and what am I drinking?
Those are European Piscos. Sorry, those are European brandies. So in your right hand, you have a very young cognac. And in your left hand, you have a 30-year-old Calvados.
Okay, so wait. Cognac is also a brandy.
Cognac is a brandy from Cognac, France.
Oh, so it's from the cognac wine.
You're
literally
a two-fisted drinker right now.
I'm not really drinking.
I like this. I need a picture of this.
whoops.
So the thing I want to say about that, and you did say that you tasted some things and they had sugar added to them, or they were kind of sweet. In Europe, it is legal for you to add sugar to whatever distillate you want to a certain percentage. Some of these guys do, some of them don't.
But when they're adding...
The one in your right hand, I'm not going to say which brand it is, but that does have some sugar added to
sugar?
It. Yes.
And when they're adding the sugar, are they manipulating the spirit because they didn't get what they wanted out of it when they distilled it? Is it worse fruit? I mean, I just feel like sugar is cheating.
Sugar... technically is cheating.
Okay.
The one in your left hand, that's a Calvados, and there's been no sugar added to that.
It's for the uninformed
palate. It's fantastic.
But here's the thing about Calvados. Calvados is from apples.
Yes.
Apples are way sweeter than grapes. So
yes.
You're not going to need, I would assume, sugar
So
when you're making this wine.
You have to have sugar to some extent.
Sure, natural.
But the type of apple that you use. So I can have a regular, like Granny Smith apple or a regular... red apple that you would get from the grocery store. And
what was that? You drinking so much you hit the microphone with your glass?
With my glass.
Calm down, girl.
So all apples have some type of sugar content, but you can eat like a regular red apple and it'll have high sugar content, but it'll have a very low tannin content. Now, when you're dealing with grapes and especially apple brandies, you want an apple that's going to have a higher tannin content and be more tart. So it might still have the same amount of sugar, but it doesn't taste as though it does.
As though it does.
And that's what makes a spirit for aging for a very long time. You need a spirit that has a lot of tannin.
Okay.
Which is why they only make Cognac and Armagnac from three certain types of grapes that are meant to be aged for a very long time.
All right, what's the difference between Cognac and Armagnac?
I brought the both yak? Of them for you okay. here.
Is it the yak?
Yeah, so, but, you know, I think people, well, maybe because maybe I'm not as educated on brandy as I thought I was, but I didn't realize Cognac and Armagnac were both under the brandy umbrella.
Yes.
Okay.
So they are both different types of brandy. They come from two different regions
I
in
knew
France.
That.
They can be prepared the same way, but for, you know, simplest of terms, when I was telling you about how vodka and gin producers produce gins in a kind of column still that just runs continuously, that is typically kind of how Armagnac is produced. They use a column still that's attached to a pot, and it basically distills at a much higher rate.
Where did the names come from?
The areas.
Armagnac is an area?
Armagnac
I don't know.
Is an area.
It's an area. Well, I don't and go so to is France. Cognac. Right. He doesn't go to
I
France.
Don't like France.
You should
it's
go
okay.
to France.
No, no.
no. I want to go
out.
To France.
France
so
is out.
I've been,
France
and I want to go back.
You can go after I'm dead.
No, I'm going as soon as I get
year.
A ticket. Okay, take me with you. take
you know.
Me with you.
I'll keep you posted.
You don't know your pain. You start carrying that suitcase around, you'll be sorry.
But no, they are from two different areas, and they're essentially made from the same three grapes. They're just made in a different way.
So what are the three grapes? And are we talking red grapes or white grapes, or is it a mix?
So it can be a mix, but here's the deal. Anytime you smash a grape, it's always going to be white juice. It
sure.
doesn't matter what the grape itself looks like, and you guys know that.
Because that's all about
mine.
Skin contact, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But typically when you're dealing with a cognac, you're not looking for that skin contact because you don't want that to come through on the still. So you're looking for, you know, a fresh flavor of a grape to come by.
Okay. So when we're talking about Cognac and Armagnac, I feel like there are a lot of people who are big lovers of Armagnac as an after-dinner drink.
Exactly.
But it's never sort of been presented to me that it's the same thing as Cognac? Or can you, if you were to taste them, could you tell the difference?
I could definitely tell the difference.
Okay.
And
what are we looking for in order to
pro.
Tell the difference? Well, you have to train your palate.
Don't try this at home.
Armagnac is a little bit more forward in the wood, tends to be, and I'm just making a generalization here, the wood tends to be a little bit more pronounced.
That's what I was going to say. It tastes sort of this woody.
So
a little bit, yeah.
After it's distilled,
yes,
they barrel it.
Yes.
Okay, so that would be the big difference. That's why it's brown.
When you're dealing with Cognac and Armagnac, after they distill it, they will put it in barrels and they'll store it for however many years, but then they are constantly blending. You're never going to have a single vintage
or a single origin kind of thing.
Exactly.
Got it.
So even if you might get a bottle that says 1965 or something like that, it's still a blend of different types of brandy from different years.
Because, well, once you distill it, it's no longer active.
It depends. Things can still change over time, especially when you're dealing with barrels and, you
well,
know,
there's
how you're
evaporation.
Aging
it. Does that affect it?
It does affect it on a very high level, which is why so many cognacs are so expensive, because as you're aging a product for 50 years, you're losing 3% of that every single year.
Sure.
So the older it is, obviously that happens with whiskey as well.
So with Cognac and Armagnac, how long, the ones like, for example, that we're drinking, how long are they aged for?
So the one in your left hand is 30 years.
Wow.
The one in your right hand is about, it's a blend of cognac that is between 6 months to 3 years.
Okay.
But it's still very rich.
Sure. No, it's actually really rich. It's delicious. But what I find really fascinating is, I assume for an Armagnac, those wineries make other products, because you can't just wait 30 years for your product to come out.
Exactly.
How do you make any money?
That's the best thing about the agriculture in France, is that a lot of these distillers are growing other things on their estate. They have cows, they're selling cheese, they're growing other food for agricultural reasons. For instance, the DuPont family were selling apples first, and they were only distilling the apples because they would go bad. So whatever they didn't sell, they would distill it and just have the brandy stores lined up and aging in their cellars until they found out that there was a huge market for this eau de vie of apples.
So does brandy, if you get a fabulous bottle of cognac, you spend all this money, what's the shelf life once it's opened? Once oxygen hits, what do you got on it?
You, essentially, I don't think you're going to be alive long enough to see that bottle evaporate out.
Okay.
Plus, it's not, so a wooden barrel
is porous.
You've
got to live long enough to get the kids into college.
That's all.
A wooden barrel is porous, so it's letting air out and letting things in, and it's influencing the flavor. Whereas you put something in a bottle, and it's closed off to the elements. So you can open that, you can drink it. It's not really going anywhere, depending on what type of cork you have. This one here is a synthetic cork, so that'll probably stay in there.
And which is that
forever.
One?
Forever. This is a different Pisco. It's just made from a single varietal. It's mm-hmm. made from one grape, which is the Quebranta grape.
And that is all Pisco from Peru?
So there's a yes and no to that.
Okay.
Because the areas that are Chile and Pisco, or Chile and Pisco now, were once basically the same country. So they split. They had a couple wars. So now Peruvians say that Pisco is only made in Peru, and Chileans say that Pisco comes from Chile. So I have a Chilean Pisco here mm-hmm. as well.
It's a pretty bottle.
A Peruvian Pisco. That's Papa? Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Does it amaze you how many things people can find to fight about?
It's art.
Let's have yeah. a war
so
over.
So is there designations like there are for wine on Pisco?
There are. Okay. So in Peru, you can only make Pisco from 8 specific grapes, and you are not allowed to add any additional water to that product. In Chile, the laws are a little bit more relaxed. They have about 3 grapes that they can make a Pisco from, but you're allowed to age it and manipulate it kind of in any way after you've
so
created the spirit.
So is Pisco a brandy that would age well? Is it something that you would, is it like a wine in that you could buy it and cellar it? Or no, you buy it and you drink it?
Some people wouldn't want me to say, yes, you can age it. But I have had some fantastic
Añejo.
Don't worry, Glendon. They're not listening.
Right. So.
Some of the Pisco producers that support me in what I do.
Oh, okay.
So
we won't tell them you said that.
In Chile, I've had some fantastic Añejo Pisco. Mm-hmm. I've had them here as well. I don't think that it takes away from the spirit in any way because it's not like aging a whiskey. A whiskey is meant to be aged, but you're also trying to start out with a product that's a lot lighter in flavor. Whereas with Pisco, you've seen that the unaged spirit already has a ton of flavor to it, but it comes through in the aging still.
So you can age it.
You can.
You can. You can hold on to it.
Not legally in Peru if you're a producer.
Right.
But you can take it home and age it if you want.
Does it blow your mind that you know all of this?
No, it's awesome.
I study this regularly. It would actually...
I mean, when you're sitting around with your family, they go, Glendon, we never thought you'd amount to a damn thing.
Don't say
and
that.
Here you are. No, I mean, like, your knowledge is encyclopedic. It's a little intimidating.
Like I said, I try to learn every single thing I can about how everything is made. So I can give that knowledge on to the guest and also the people that I'm training and the people that work for me, because I need the people that work for me to be just as knowledgeable.
Well, so what is the education process at Service Bar?
The education process at Service Bar is very extensive.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had a bar back that started with us last year when we opened, and he basically almost a year later started doing regular bar shifts just because we kind of got him from ground level and kind of taught them everything that we knew. But honestly, when we bring new bartenders in, we have to bring in someone that has a base of knowledge of how to make spirits and what they are, and then we kind of go from there.
So is it a lot of tastings and playing? And so, because you're going to be doing this brandy cocktail room.
Yes.
So explain how that works and how you educate your staff, because you have an expansive amount of brandies.
We
and you
do.
Really have to know it.
Yes. So we have, so the menu at Service Bar is also split up by spirit category. So we have our whiskeys, we have our gin, we have our brandy sections. So when we're doing brandy cocktail room, it's a little bit easy for us because we know the products that we have and the bartenders themselves have already tasted it. But we have an employee meeting every Monday at noon where we're tasting spirits and we're tasting cocktails. So to that, that's how we're getting our palates prepared, and that's how we keep everyone evolving in what they're doing.
And how often do you sort of change out the spirits at the bar? Do you, is that based on consumer consumption?
We don't.
No, you know what I mean? Like, do people just keep coming in with new spirits? Because the market is growing.
Yes.
Exponentially.
So the gift and the curse of Service Bar is that a lot of people want to work with us because we produce a lot of cocktails, and I'm very happy that people think the cocktails that we make are very good. Now, the curse of Service Bar is that our bar is so small that I physically cannot fit your bottle on my shelf, but people are constantly trying to get their bottle on my shelf. But the good thing is I'm constantly tasting products, and I know which products are good. The base of spirits, we had to taste maybe around 800 spirits to get our base list for what Service Bar is now. So
were you sleeping on the floor?
A lot of times, you know, you are.
It's like, hey, it's a living and it's work.
I want to interject that you should write a mystery novel, a thriller called The Curse of Service
the
Bar.
The Curse of Service Bar. But I mean, you have to taste. So like for our old fashioned, for instance, it's half brandy and half whiskey. But we had to taste a bunch of whiskeys to say, hey, I think we like this whiskey. But then we had to taste that whiskey as an old fashioned. And we had to do that with a brandy. Then we had to taste them together. So we do that with every single spirit.
So wait, old fashioned is half brandy, half whiskey?
Our old fashioned Service Bar is half brandy, half whiskey.
What is a classic?
An old fashioned in general is any spirit with sugar and bitters and water added to it.
That's it?
Yes.
I mean, that's
an old fashioned is not a whiskey drink. It is a spirit drink. It just happens to be dominated by a country where our national spirit is whiskey.
Okay. So you do half brandy and half whiskey. So what was the end result? Which did you go with?
Delicious.
No, I know, but which spirit?
So we went with Lestau, Spanish brandy, and Wild Turkey, American bourbon. It had the right amount of wood contact. It wasn't too woody. Wasn't too sweet. We basically added the brandy to add a rich layer to it. So you're not getting this very over-the-top, very strong cocktail. Mm-hmm. You're getting something that's very well-balanced, that's rich and smooth, and you can have two or three of them. Same alcohol content of a regular old-fashioned. It just...
I would be on the floor.
Right. And what about... Do you have an ice program as well? How important is ice to you?
Ice is super important to me. We have about 4 or 5 different types of ice at Service Bar. Also, the curse of Service Bar is that I don't have enough space to produce all the ice that I want. So like large blocks and things like that, I do get that cut for me. But like,
which is amazing. Like that's a whole business in and of its own right now.
That's because your provider only has ice for you.
Now, after a few years, I've become a little bit...
That went right past him. Come on, Glenda, get with it, man.
No, it's not true. It's not true.
He's like, no, I just didn't laugh. Yeah. That's what happened there. Okay, so because we're almost done here.
Yep.
The brandy room at Service Bar.
Yes.
How is this going to be executed?
So every other month, we're going to have a spirit brand donate product to us. And we're basically going to sell brandy cocktails for a lower price than you normally would. And at the same time, we have a full charcuterie. We have food there for people if they want to come by and have bites. But it's kind of like a French or Italian happy hour. You go into the bar, you pay for your cocktails, and you get, you know, free food, essentially. And then we'll also have the producers from the brandy spirits themselves at the event tasting people at a table. So you come in, you're just having cocktails every other month, last Monday of every other month. With different producers. The next one is Hennessy in March.
Okay. So when you say brandy cocktails,
yes.
Other than Pisco Sour,
exactly.
Which I now know is a brandy cocktail, what are other, and I guess your Old Fashioned is a brandy cocktail.
Yes.
What are some other cocktails that brandy is regularly featured in? The only thing I can think of is Brandy's Alexander.
Yeah.
Right?
So we always have a guest bartender as well. So we can do classic cocktails, and I tend to lean towards creating new cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
So we split our cocktails up into 5 categories. One is a Collins or a Fizz. That's something with some type of bubbles. An aperitif, which is something that you would start your meal with, something that's light, a little bit bitter. Then your spirit forward drinks, which would be a Manhattan or an old fashioned. And then we also have a cobbler. A cobbler, you know, typically with crushed ice, some type of fruit. And then we have a sour. So a sour would be like a sidecar. That's a cognac sour, essentially. And then a julep or a cobbler would be like a mint julep, but we would use brandy instead, which is what we use at Service Bar. We use that brandy whiskey blend. So we split them into those categories, and then we take spirit that would fit into those categories. So a Pisco Sour would be in the sour section, or we can make a Tom Collins, but make it with Pisco, which is also in Peru. They have a Chilcano, which is basically the Peruvian version of a Moscow Mule made with Pisco, Pisco and ginger ale.
See, I think that's so interesting. I don't know if people really understand how interchangeable
exactly
drinks are.
And that's why we're trying to do Brandy Cocktail Room, so we could explain to people that these products are very approachable to you. You just have to know how to use them.
Do you do classes for the consumer?
We had originally thought of doing classes for the consumer, and that's kind of why we started the Brandy Cocktail Room up again, to let the guests know that we are doing something new and we are trying to educate. And once that market builds for classes for us to do, then we would definitely welcome that at Service Bar. It's also why we're closed half the day. We open at 5, so we can actually do things like that either during the day or on Monday evenings, because we're closed on Mondays as well.
All right, well, let's make sure everybody knows where Service Bar is and how to find you on the street and online.
Please find us at 926 U Street. That's on U between 9th and 10th, and at brandycocktailroom.com and servicebardc.com.
And we got to make sure, because this show goes all over the world. I'm not sure you knew that. Literally, they're listening to us in Shanghai right now.
Nice.
So we're talking about Washington, D.C., all yes. you people out there in Shanghai land.
Well, we want to thank you so much for this education.
Thank you for having
me. And it was very delicious, and I feel like I've learned so much. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today. I'm going to tell them what's on next week.
I feel like I have to Uber home now.
Okay. We want to thank all of you for listening with us today. Next week, we are bringing in studio Kathy Hollinger. She is the executive director of the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington, and we're talking about tipping. It is a big issue, and she has a lot to say about it.
It's not cow tipping, right?
No, it's not cow tipping. It's tipping. Industry night with Foodie and the Beast.
Oh, it's not a farming show.
And we are talking about.
No wonder I didn't understand anything anybody said.
There we go.
Right.
On that note, we want to thank you all for joining us today. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We'll see you next Monday night.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.